Acts chapter 7, we're going to pick up in just a moment at about verse 7 or 8. We ended there in our context. Remember, Stephen is before the Sanhedrin Council. The charge has gone out against him. Back in chapter 6 and in verse 11, then they secretly induced men to say, "We have heard him speak blasphemous words against Moses and against God." Verse 14 of chapter 6, "For we heard him say that this Jesus of Nazareth will destroy this place and change the customs which Moses delivered to us." So Stephen is before the Sanhedrin Council. He is giving a defense for himself. But on this occasion, as we look at this chapter and his defense before the Sanhedrin Council, he doesn't begin by saying, "No, I didn't say this, I didn't say that." He doesn't defend what he has said. You might say, what he does in this defense of himself before the Sanhedrin Council is he condemns the unbelief that is before him as he presents God's will for man's life. And so in chapter 7, let's run quickly through a few of the first verses and get down into the context. Chapter 7 and verse 1, he is before the Sanhedrin Council, and the high priest asks him, "Are these things so? Are these charges so against you?" The high priest, or perhaps Caiaphas under consideration, could be Annas. Chapter 7 and verse 2, he said, "Brethren and fathers, listen, the God of glory appeared to our father Abraham when he was in Mesopotamia before he dwelt in Haran." What Luke does here in this account of Stephen's defense is he begins with some Old Testament worthies. He begins with Abraham. Then we're going to see he passes from Abraham to Jacob, whose later was named Israel, and his 12 sons. And from that he's going to move to Moses, and that's going to continue down to about verse 40 or 42, 44, somewhere in that context. So each one of these, as he presents, I want you to note, and we mentioned this last Lord's Day morning as well, the main subject of the entire text of chapter 7 is God. God is put first and foremost. God has made a plan, and he is bringing out the plan to save man in Christ Jesus. That plan began with Abraham in the context. Then it went from Joseph and his sons, and from Joseph it went to Moses. And as God disclosed his plan, we see these Old Testament worthies that are mentioned here. They're in obedience to God's will and God's plan, but those to whom Stephen is standing before on this occasion are unbelievers. They're disobedient. So you might say he puts them in direct opposition to what God has said throughout his word. Acts 7 and verse 3, "And he said to him, get out of your country and from your relatives and come to a land that I will show you." That is to the land of Canaan. Genesis 12 and verse 1. Now as we read through this, I kind of got off in some history last week. I'm going to try to stay out of the history and just kind of stick with the text a little bit more. I'll mention some of the history, I'll mention some of the references, but if you have a reference Bible, you can run the references and the historical settings of these things that are mentioned for yourself. Acts 7 and verse 4, "Then he came," that is Abraham, "came out of the land of Chaldeans." Remember, the land of the Chaldeans was the land of Mesopotamia, referred to as the land of Chaldeans because it was the land of the Babylonians, referred to as Chaldeans simply because the kings that ruled over that region were from Chaldea. "And he came out of the land of the Chaldeans and dwelt in Haran, and from there, when his father was dead," his father was named Terah, "he moved him to this land in which he now dwell." That is, God resettled Abraham out of the land of Mesopotamia into the land of Canaan, in which the people to whom he was addressing was now living. Acts 7 and in verse 5, "And God gave him no inheritance in it, not even enough to set his foot on. Though God had promised Abraham this land, Abraham actually received no inheritance of it, not even a small portion enough to set his foot upon. But even when Abraham had no child, he promised to give him that as a possession and his descendants after him, that is, his seed after him. So it was promised as an inheritance to Abraham. Abraham would never receive it as an inheritance. Some of his descendants would never even receive it as an inheritance. It would be many years before they even receive this promised land, the land of Canaan. Many, many years. But God promised it, and that which he promises in his word comes true. All of this has to do with the argument that Stephen makes before this Sanhedrin council here. God makes a promise. God directs people. People follow his will. They receive the end of the promise that God has made to the Sanhedrin council in Stephen's day. God had promised salvation in Jesus Christ. God has sent Jesus Christ into the world. Well, who was it that directed Abraham? It was God. Well, God directed Jesus Christ, sent him into the world to save mankind. Just as people had rejected Abraham, just as they rejected Joseph and his children, just as they rejected Moses and his law, they reject God's will throughout their life. Acts 7 and verse 6, but God spoke in this way, to Abraham, that his descendants would dwell in a foreign land, and that they would bring them into bondage and oppress them 400 years. We ended here in this text last Lord's Day morning. His descendants, that is his seed. To dwell here is a word that means to dwell as a stranger, a temporary resident, that they would dwell in a foreign land. So they're strangers in a foreign land. Why are they strangers in a foreign land? Why are they aliens in a foreign land? Because their citizenship really belongs in the land of promise, the land of Canaan. It's like the Christian citizenship. His place of citizenship is in heaven. But the land of Canaan had been promised to the descendants of the seed of Abraham. So while they're away in this foreign land simply means a land that belongs to another. So while they're away in this foreign land that belongs to someone else, they're aliens. They're strangers. They're simply temporary residents because their place of abode is truly the land of Canaan. But note this, that his descendants would dwell in a foreign land, and that they would bring them into bondage. That is, that they would bring them into slavery. The foreign land, of course, under consideration is the land of Egypt. So Abraham has been called out of the Ur of the Chaldees. He's been called out of the land of Mesopotamia. He comes to the land of promise. And God has promised it to him, to his descendants, to his seed after him. But before he will receive it, before his seed will receive it, his seed's going to be taken into slavery in Egypt. And they're going to be oppressed. That is, they're going to be ill-treated, harmed, and injured for 400 years. Some versions say 430 years. We're simply to take the 400 years as a rounded-off number here. Acts 7 and verse 7. And the nation to whom they will be in bondage, I will judge. I'll bring condemnation upon, said God. And he did. And after that, they shall come out and serve me in this place. After that, they shall come out and serve me. The word serve here means to worship me. They'll come out and worship me in this place. What place? In the land of Canaan, particularly in Jerusalem, in the temple. Remember, this place had been mentioned back in the context, chapter 6 and in verse 14. For when they heard him say that this Jesus will destroy this place and change the cups of which Moses delivered to us. So when they come out of the land of Egypt, because God's going to judge the Egyptians because they held his people in Egyptian bondage, in Egyptian slavery, he's going to judge that nation and, you might say, redeem his people from that Egyptian bondage and bring them back into the land of Canaan. And there they will worship him. They will serve him in this place. Acts 7 and verse 8. Then he gave him the covenant of circumcision. Note that, he gave him. God is always put forward in this context. It is God who is bringing all of this about. He has brought this about that has taken place in the city of Jerusalem. but those of the Sanhedrin council most have rejected it, and of course do not see that as being God's work or God's plan. So he gave him the covenant of circumcision. And so Abraham begot Isaac, and Isaac circumcised him on the eighth day. Isaac begot Jacob, and Jacob begot the 12 patriarchs. So God gave him the covenant of circumcision. It was a covenant made between God and Abraham. It was an agreement made between them. Now God sets the standards. He sets the conditions of the agreement. It was a covenant relationship between Abraham and his descendants who would follow after him. God made this covenant with Abraham before he had his son mentioned in the context, Isaac. But after Isaac was born, he circumcised him. Why? Because God commanded it. Abraham obeyed God. When God said, "Get out of your country and from your family or your relatives and go to a place that I will show you," Abraham obeyed. When God made a covenant with Abraham, set the conditions of that covenant, Abraham obeyed. It was something that these before whom Stephen stood on this occasion, the Sanhedrin council, was not doing. They were not in obedience to God. So God gave him the covenant of circumcision, so Abraham begot Isaac, that is, according to God's promise. Remember, Isaac was the child of promise. Ishmael, Abraham's son before him, through the maidservant, was not the child of promise, but God had promised to turn Abraham into a great nation. That is, there would be many nations who would come from him. Remember, his name started out as Abram, but God changed his name to Abraham, meaning father of many nations. So many nations of people were going to come from Abraham. God had made that promise to him before he even had any children at all. But God brings all of that about. And that promised son, Isaac, was circumcised on the eighth day according to God's will. And Isaac begot Jacob. Remember, Jacob's name was later changed to Israel. Jacob had 12 sons. He begot the 12 patriarchs. That is, the founders of the tribes. The tribes of Israel, the 12 tribes of Israel, the 12 patriarchs, the founders or heads or chiefs of those tribes. And the patriarchs, becoming envious, sold Joseph into Egypt, but God was with him. The patriarchs, that is the 12 sons, becoming envious. They were jealous of Joseph. Now you can go and read the history of this back in Genesis 37. Sold Joseph into Egyptian slavery. But note this, God was with him. God was with Joseph. Why was God with him? Well, it was God's plan. God is working all of this out. As a matter of fact, Joseph later on, after he was sold into Egyptian slavery and spent some time in Egypt, recognized and realized that this was God's plan all along. Acts 7 and verse 10. Acts 7 and verse 10. And so God was with him, and God delivered him out of all of his troubles. Note who is again put forward in the text. God is managing all of this. God is bringing all of this about. So he delivered him. He rescued him. He took him out of all of his afflictions and danger and suffering and persecution. And he gave him favor and wisdom. That is, he showed grace to him. And he gave him wisdom, that is, the ability to utilize the knowledge that he had with his experience, common sense, and insight. And so God gave him favor and wisdom in the presence of Pharaoh, that is, before Pharaoh. That is, in the opinion and in the judgment of Pharaoh, Joseph was a man of great wisdom. Pharaoh here is not the name of the emperor himself, but it's a title for the emperors of Egypt. Like in the first century, the Roman emperors were named Caesar. So in Egypt, during this particular period of time under consideration, the emperors were referred to as pharaohs. And that continued until the Persian invasion of Egypt. So God gave him favor and presence in the in the presence of Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and he made him governor over Egypt and all of his house. So because of the favor that God had shown to Joseph, because of the wisdom that had been granted to him, Pharaoh made him governor. Now, the word governor here is a noun to us in the English language. Simply refers to a magistrate of some sort, a chief magistrate. But actually, it's a verb in the Greek. That is, he put him in charge. That's the idea. He made him a governor. That is, Pharaoh put him in charge. He put him in charge of all of Egypt. And he put him in charge of even his house, over his family, and all the servants that he had. Indeed, Joseph had been elevated to a position in the land of Egypt, higher than any other person in the land of Egypt other than Pharaoh, simply because of God's favor and wisdom upon him. Acts 7 and verse 11. Now famine and great trouble came over the land of Egypt and Canaan, and our fathers found no substance. A famine, a severe shortage of food. Now, a famine during this particular period of time wasn't just the grocery stores at empty shelves. When a famine hit the land in a time period like this, there was no food for beast, that is, for animal or man, because man mostly consumed the food that the animals consumed. It was prepared in different ways. Animals consumed grain, and man consumed grain, different kinds of grain, and it was processed, of course, made into bread and so forth. But a famine brought about starvation. It brought about great death. And that's the famine that is under consideration. People are in violent hunger, starvation and death. Now, famine and great trouble. Great. The word is used to magnify the famine. Great trouble, great distress, great affliction, great suffering. Now, famine and great trouble came over all the land of Egypt and Canaan, and our fathers had no substance. Now, it didn't affect the people in Egypt. Do you remember the history? Why didn't this famine affect the people in Egypt? Does anyone remember? Because Joseph, in his wisdom that God had given him, had been revealed to him that there was going to be a great famine, and Joseph prepared the people of Egypt for that famine. He stored away 7 years of grain, because that's how long the famine was going to last. You imagine how many people would starve to death in a famine of 7 years. And so the famine was over all the land of Egypt, note this, and Canaan. So where are the descendants of Abraham at this time? Well, Joseph is in Egyptian bondage. He's in the land of Egypt. But the brothers that sold him and the rest of their family are still back in the land of Canaan. And our fathers found no substance. Our fathers, our ancestors here, they found no substance. The word substance here is simply the coarse food of animals. The coarse food of animals, understood as a possible source of human nourishment. They found no substance. There was no grain, not even for beast nor man either. Acts 7 and verse 12. But when Jacob heard that there was grain in Egypt, there was no internet. How did he hear? Canaan was a long way from the land of Egypt. But word spreads. But when Jacob heard that there was grain in Egypt, grain, that is the dry seed, the fruit produced by the cereal grasses of the land, there was grain in Egypt, he sent out our fathers first. You can go to Genesis 42 and read about this. Remember Joseph, having learned that there was grain in Egypt, sent some of his sons to Egypt to see if they could acquire some grain so they could bring it back and preserve their family, preserve their livestock. Acts 7 and verse 13 through 15. Acts 7, 13 through 15. And the second time, Joseph was made known to his brothers, and Joseph's family became known to Pharaoh. The second time. Remember, his brothers went into the land of Egypt the first time and received grain. And of course, stipulations and conditions were made, and they were supposed to come back and they would receive more grain. And that's the second time under consideration. Again, you can go to the book of Genesis and read about this. So the second time, Joseph was made known to his brothers. He came to be known by his brothers as the one they had sold into Egyptian slavery. And so Joseph's family became known to Pharaoh. Not only did his brothers learn this, but his family became known to Pharaoh, that is to the king of Egypt. Then Joseph sent and called his father Jacob and all of his relatives to him, 75 people. So Jacob went down to Egypt and he died, he and our fathers. So there's a lot of history there. Jacob and his sons go down to Egypt. Jacob dies while they're in Egypt. The 12 sons die while they're in Egypt. Acts 7 and verse 16. And they were carried back to Shechem and laid in the tomb that Abraham bought for a sum of money from the sons of Hamor, the father of Shechem. Shechem is located in the northern part of the land of Canaan. And so they were carried back. Who were carried back? Well, those in reference back in verse 14 and 15. So they were carried back to Shechem and laid in the tomb that Abraham bought for a sum of money from the sons of Hamor. You know, some today, when they die, they're carried back to the place where they grew up. They're carried back to their homeland. They're carried back to the place where their family was. Why didn't they just bury them in Egypt? Because they were aliens there. They were strangers in a foreign land. Their place of residence was in the land of Canaan. And so that's where they were carried back to. This place had been bought for a sum of money from the sons of Hamor by the father of Shechem. Acts 7 and verse 17. But when the time of the promise drew near, which God had sworn to Abraham, the people grew and multiplied in Egypt. When the time of the promise drew near. The time of what promise? Well, the promise that God had made to Abraham, that in thy seed all the nations of the earth should be blessed. Abraham was told, even before he had any children, that your descendants or your seed after you is going to become as numerous as the stars of heaven. Before he even had any children, that promise was made to God. So when the time of the promise drew near, when the time of the promise of receiving the inheritance in the land of Canaan, when that promise came near, when it was about to be fulfilled, which God had sworn to Abraham, the people grew. That is, they increased in number. They multiplied in Egypt. So 75 people go into Egypt. How long did they stay there, back in the context? 430 years. 430 years, 75 people had turned into a multitude so great as it was considered as the numerous as the stars of heaven. Acts 7 and verse 17 is where we're at. And so, just imagine this. Now, while they were in slavery, in Egyptian bondage, increasing and multiplying in number, Pharaoh and the leaders of the land would become upset. You know, here we have these foreigners, here we have these aliens whom we have allowed to come and let live in the land, and then we have enslaved them, but they're becoming so numerous it poses a problem for us. What if they decided to cause an uprising? What if they decided they wanted to take over the land? Because they're so numerous, they could. So they grew, they increased in number, they multiplied in Egypt. Note this, verse 18. Till another king arose who did not know Joseph. To another Pharaoh arose who did not know Joseph. Another. There's that word, another. There's two different Greek words in the Greek translated another. You ought to remember this because it's significant in Scripture. They're easy to remember. Hetros is the word here. And the other word is allos. Allos. Allos was used in connection with Jesus when he made that promise to the apostles that he would send another helper. Allos, another helper, another of the same kind, another of the same nature. Jesus was deity, so he was going to send another helper, another of the same nature as he. He was going to send the Holy Spirit. Here the word is heteros in the Greek, another. Another of a different sort, another of a different kind, another of a different nature. Before, the Pharaoh was of such nature that they allowed. Remember the first Pharaoh, because of Joseph's wisdom, because God's favor upon him, Pharaoh was very favorable toward him. But as time went on, another king of a different nature arose who simply did not know Joseph. Acts 7 and verse 19. This man, this Pharaoh, dwelt treacherously with our people and oppressed our forefathers, making them expose their babies so that they might not live. Now, here's opposition to God. The opposition, of course, is those who are trying to put down and enslave God's people. But God is working his plan. Remember, he's made this promise to Abraham. The time is drawing near for the people to come out of this place of bondage, and God is going to judge this nation. They're going to come to the land of Canaan and worship God. And so this man dwelt treacherously with our people. Means to exploit, to take advantage of deceitfully. That's what this king did. As a matter of fact, he increased their bondage. He increased their slavery. And to try to keep, and this is, you can see this in the context. What's the Sanhedrin Council trying to do? They're trying to keep God's plan of man's salvation in Christ Jesus from unfolding and taking place. And the Pharaoh was trying to keep, he was trying to thwart God's plan. But who's mightier than God? Pharaoh? In no way. God is still going to bring to pass his promise he's made to Abraham. And God is still going to win, regardless of what the Sanhedrin Council do to Stephen. So this Pharaoh deals treacherously, deceitfully with the people of God, the Israelites, the Hebrews. And he oppressed our forefathers. He mistreated them, making them expose their babies so that they might not live. To expose, that is, to leave their babies exposed, to abandon their babies. That is, remember, when you go back and read the account of Genesis, Pharaoh's plan was, well, I'll decrease the number of these Hebrews in the land. The way I will decrease the number of these Hebrews in the land is I'll kill all the male babies. I'll just have them killed. Now, if a female is born, that's all right. But if a male is born, the warring side of a nation, they'll be put to death. To expose the babies simply means to abandon them. Lay them out somewhere so the wild animals will take them. Put them in the river so the crocodiles will eat them. They become food for the wild beast. Now, you see, times haven't changed. People destroy the lives of babies today. Times haven't changed at all. Many people don't understand that abortion started out with the idea of destroying those who were undesirable. And it still continues. They say they're undesirable, so we'll just destroy them by taking their life. At least the babies were born, but then they were abandoned. They were laid out and exposed. For what purpose? Well, note that. So that they might not live. So that. That's the purpose. They were exposed so that they would not live. So the multitude of Hebrews would be decreased in the land of Egypt. So at this time, verse 20, Acts 7, at this time Moses was born. and was well pleasing to God, and he was brought up in his father's house for 3 months. So at the time that male babies were being exposed, at the time the male babies were being, you might say, fed to the crocodiles, Moses was born during this particular period of time. Jochebed was his mother. Amram was his father. They were both came from the tribe of Levi. And Moses had an older brother named Aaron and an older sister named Miriam. And so at this time, Moses was born. So beginning here, he's going to speak about Moses. And this will continue down to verse 40-something in our context. So at this time, Moses was born and was well-pleasing to God. Well-pleasing here means he was handsome, he was beautiful, refined and tasteful in appearance or behavior. He was well-pleasing to God. And he was brought up in his father's house. He was reared, cared for, and taken care of for 3 months. They hid him out in their home for 3 months. How do you hide a little crying baby in a land that is filled with people? Everybody knows you've got a baby. They hear it crying at night. So for 3 months they preserve the life of this child. But then his mother has a plan. Acts 7 and verse 21. But when he was set out, Pharaoh's daughter took him away and brought him up as her own son. When he was set out. Now you can go and read this in Genesis account. Most of you are familiar with it. Note that. When he was set out. When he was set out. When he was exposed. So his mother decides that, well, we're going to have to put him out for the crocodiles. That's Pharaoh's demand. But it's a plan to save his life. It's not a plan to lose his life.
Yes, I never have really given it a lot of thought. You mentioned Aaron just now. How did Aaron survive?
Well, evidently he must have been several years older than Moses. He must have been at an age where...
he had to come into place yet.
Right.
I just got to wondering about that when you mentioned.
Yeah. And Miriam was old enough that she was even put out to watch the baby Moses as he was in the river, you know, to watch over him to make sure that his life wasn't in danger. So when he was set out, that is when he was exposed, back in verse 19. So when he was exposed, Pharaoh's daughter took him away. Remember, she exposed him in the river. Put him in the reeds of the river, and Miriam watched over him. But Pharaoh's daughter, along with others from the king's palace, would come to the river and would bathe in the river. And of course, as they come to the river and as they bathe, the child, Moses, is put in that location, and of course, they see the child. And she takes him up as her own. She takes him up. She adopts him as her own. Remember, Miriam on this occasion, as she's watching over him, even says to the daughter, says, do you want me to find someone to nurse the child? Remember, the child is only 3 months old. And so this princess, this daughter of the king, would not spend all of her time with this young child. After all, she's a king's daughter. She would need someone to rear it, to raise it, to nurse it. Acts 7 and verse 22, and that's what she did. She allowed Miriam herself, not Miriam. She allowed the mother of Moses to do that. Acts 7 and verse 22, and Moses was learned in all the wisdom of the Egyptians and was mighty in words and deeds. And Moses was learned. He was educated. He was instructed. He was shaped through the teaching and discipline and knowledge of all that the Egyptians had. And he was mighty in words and deeds. He was mighty. He was powerful. He was very competent and capable in speaking, in communicating, and in acting, in deeds, and in behavior, in works.
You're talking there, mighty in speech and stuff. Yet in one part he says he needed Aaron to speak for him because he was slow.
Yes, well, but Moses used that as an excuse.
Okay.
Yeah. Sometimes we're competent and capable and able and powerful and mighty enough. We don't see ourselves as that way. And Moses used that excuse. He didn't see himself that way. But he was very capable. He was very able to do that which God planned for him to do. But he used that as an excuse to try to get out of doing what God planned him to do. That's why he wanted Aaron to speak for him. Acts 7 and verse 23. Now when he was 40 years old, we're going to see in this context that that the life of Moses is broken down in 40-year time frames. 40-year time frames. 40 years here in the context. Later on, he's going to speak of another 40 years. Later on, he's going to speak of another 40 years. It's based upon the tradition that Moses lived to be 120 years of age. So here's the first 40 years in the land of Egypt. Now, when he was 40 years old, so his first 40 years in the land of Egypt, it came into his heart to visit his brethren, the children of Israel. So it came into his heart. That is, he purposed in his mind. He made the determination in his mind to visit, that is, to look upon in order to help and to benefit, to aid and to care for and to provide for his brethren. That is, his fellow Hebrews. That's the brethren under consideration. Because he knew himself to be a Hebrew. He was not an Egyptian. Who reared him up in the house of Pharaoh? His mother. She was his nurse. She cared for him. And so, he knew his brethren. He knew the children of the Hebrews, the children of Israel. Acts 7 and verse 24. And seeing one of them suffer wrong, he defended and avenged him who was oppressed, and he struck down the Egyptian. Seeing one of them suffer wrong. Remember, the Egyptians have the Hebrews in bondage. They're in slavery. And he saw one of the Hebrews suffering wrong. That is, they were being mistreated. They were being harmed. They were being injured. And he defended and avenged him. He defended him. He acted against the attack that was being made against his fellow Hebrew. And he avenged him. That is, he didn't carry out vengeance. No, he simply executed justice. That's the idea in the word here. He executed justice. So the one who was injuring the Hebrew was acting outside of justice. And so Moses defends his cause. And he executes justice on his behalf. And he struck down. That is to strike with the meaning or intent to kill or to slay. So he slew the Egyptian. He killed the Egyptian. Now, later on in the context, because we're out of time, you're going to see that that is brought up against Moses by his own people. By his own people. God has sent Moses to be a deliverer of those in Egyptian bondage. His own people are going to reject him. And of course, because they reject him, and Moses recognizes and realizes that the slaying of this Egyptian is going to come to the mind of Pharaoh, he flees for his life. He flees out of the land of Egypt for his life to the land of Midian. But God had sent Moses to deliver them. Now, God had sent Jesus to deliver these unbelieving Jews on the Sanhedrin Council. He had sent Jesus to rescue them and save them from their sins. But just as the Hebrews had rejected Moses in Egypt, the unbelieving Jews have rejected God in the first century. A type of Jesus. Very good. All right, we're out of time. We didn't get as far as I thought we would this morning, but we'll pick up here in this context next Lord's Day morning about Acts 7. Acts 7 and verse 24-25. Thank you very much for your kind attention and good comments.